Welcome back to Around the Prompt. This is Logan Kilpatrick. In today's episode, we're joined by Connor Grennan, the Chief AI Architect at NYU. It's an incredibly interesting conversation. We talk about an AI-first mindset. Connor's got a really practical approach to AI, so I'm excited to dive into this episode.
Connor, thanks for being here. Really excited to have you on and to chat. This is going to be a ton of fun. Can you take us back to November of 2022 when ChatGPT was released? I'm curious what you were doing at that time, like what your role was, what you were thinking about, and sort of take us from there to today and how that sort of has changed, how ChatGPT has sort of changed what you're thinking about and doing on a daily basis.
Yeah, first, it's great to see you guys. Thanks for having me on. Always love talking with you guys. So yeah, I mean, you know, I've been in this Dean of Students role for NYU Stern School of Business and the MBA program for about a decade. And when ChatGPT came out, you know, I didn't really pick up on it for the first few weeks or anything like that. But my wife, Liz, and is at McKinsey, she does responsible AI, and she saw it. And, you know, and she was like, hey, have you seen this thing, right? And I'm like, no, what is it? She's like, well, you should just try it. I'm like, well, for what? And she's like, for anything. I'm like, well, like what? She's like, anything. And so we were on vacation, so I didn't really want to get into an argument or anything like that. So I'm like, oh, you know what? I'm just going to take this into the other room and try it. But for me, I had been completely focused on NYU. I'd been completely focused on, you know, I do a lot around culture and, you know, HR and talent stuff, like, and, you know, and coaching MBA students on their journey, executive coaching, things like that. That was like my passion. And so when this thing came out, I was sort of taken aback because it didn't feel like anything at the moment other than, holy cow, there's this brand new wild thing. But the really cool thing was that as soon as I was on it for maybe, I don't know, an hour and a half, I was like, okay, this is going to change absolutely everything. And so I quickly wrote to my boss at NYU and I was like, we got to do something. He's like, yeah, I agree. And so being a good business school person, I was like, well, let me build out a framework just to sort of show people what this is. And the thing is, because this was in, I don't know, January or something like that, I felt really late on it. I'm like, everybody's probably already cranking on this. And so I built that out. And then just the last thing I'll say on this, it's kind of funny. I went out to, you know, people that I knew who are running finance, you know, financial firms and hedge fund, you know, presidents and asset management heads and all that kind of stuff saying, hey, how are you using this? Because I'm building out a framework for how to teach. And I'm talking about ChatGPT, about, you know, it's kind of 3.5. And I was like, how are you using this? I'm trying to build out case studies. And you guys actually probably know the answer that came back, which was like, well, we're not using it. We don't really know what it is. And that sort of started me on my journey. I'm like, this is interesting. And then the kind of catalyst for how I ended up sort of like doing a lot more stuff was I posted on LinkedIn, like, hey, I'm not a tech person at all. I have zero tech background, but this is how I'm using. So I was almost apologetic. I'm like, so I'm really sorry. I know I'm not an expert, but like, this is actually how I'm finding really utility out of it. And that's when I realized like, everybody was like, oh, cool. You don't actually need a tech background for it. So that's kind of like where I was. And that sort of metamorphosis was really exciting.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm curious, like what did that transition look like for you as somebody who didn't have a technical background, like as you were ramping up on this technology? And I think this is actually like a great case study because like most people are not technical and most people who want to learn about AI, like don't have, you know, programming background. So I'm curious, like, what were the things that you were doing initially that like really helped you get over that initial hump?
So Logan, I think that hits on everything that we're wrestling with, right? As like society right now. Right. And I'm not even sure I'm overstating that because what I get to do now is I get to go out and I train a ton of companies and things like that, like boards of directors and senior management teams and things like that. And I do a lot of speaking. And one of the first things I say is this: I have zero technical background, right? No machine learning, no AI, nothing, really, literally nothing. And yet, you know, here I am, right? Sort of speaking in front of 500 people or 1,000 people or this, you know, Fortune 50 company or something like that. So how is that possible? So first of all, the answer is, you know, I don't know how that's possible. But really the sort of fascinating thing for me was as I was testing this thing out in the early days, I'm sitting there, and I mean like the first hours, I kept waiting to hit the block where I'm like, okay, but now you need to program this or now you need to like, because that's the history of learning things, right? I mean, like you can have like a like a French phrase book and sort of study that. But as soon as somebody kind of like goes off book and they're not answering exactly how the phrase book says they're supposed to be answering, you're like, oh no, now I have to actually learn, right? But the thing about ChatGPT and other large language models, I found, all this took a long time to codify. So I'm sort of, the way I'm saying it, I wasn't in the moment, I was just like blown away, but I couldn't find the learning curve to it. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm like, where does this thing start to slope up? Where does this slow me down? All that kind of stuff. And I just kept not hitting it and not hitting it, not hitting it. And that's what was amazing to me. And so I started to think, well, gosh, this must be the easiest thing in the world to teach, right? So as I was building out this framework at Stern, what I started to do is go and attend, not lectures, but sort of where faculty would talk to other faculty about this. Like some, you know, an AI or machine learning, you know, faculty, we have brilliant faculty. And I would sit in on this and the lecture would be all, and this was for like almost like the whole school or the whole faculty would be like, okay, so here's how neural networks work. Here's what's going on behind the scenes, all that kind of stuff. And I'd be sitting there for an hour and I'd be like, so that's interesting. It is interesting. But for me, as somebody who's non-tech, I'm like, that's not what's interesting about this. In the same way, like if I have my iPhone and somebody's like, how do I use the iPhone? I'm not starting with, okay, so here's how, you know, Apple sort of like put together the software behind, like you're just saying like, guess what, man, you can order an Uber or and a latte and do your personal banking from your couch, right? It's all about the user interface of it. So for me, as somebody who's non-tech, kept waiting to hit that learning curve, kept not hitting it. But then, Logan, kind of where you're going with this, and to my point, is telling people that is very, very difficult. You can't just tell people that there's no learning curve. You have to show them. And so the first thing I say is like, this looks like to big companies, this looks like a digital transformation. I actually don't think it is. And not to say that there's not obviously a huge tech data component, of course, but I'm saying like, this is a change management exercise here. Like you have to, it's much more like figuring out how to exercise, like physically exercise, than it is like learning calculus, right? Because learning calculus, like you can sort of like track, okay, here's the beginners in the room, you're over to the left, like experts, you're over to the right, right? And you sort of try to figure out where anybody is on that journey of, you know, Excel or French or literally anything. With this, that doesn't happen. Everybody can be in the same room together. But also, I think just equally importantly, it's much more like exercise, in that exercise requires a change in behavior. It doesn't require learning. Like, eat less and exercise, man. We know, right? And yet look at me, right? Look at me. Well, don't, but like, you know what I mean? Like, but if I get a treadmill, I get on the treadmill and I get off 5 minutes later because my brain is like, no thanks. I don't try to fix the treadmill. So like, that's the thing that I try to convey. And I've spent a year talking with literally thousands of people on how to convey that.
Do you think it's working? Like, I'm curious, like this message resonates so much with me, but it does still feel like when I meet the average person who hasn't used ChatGPT or doesn't use AI every day, they think that there's this really high bar. And I wonder if like, that's just the natural trend of this technology, is like people assume that. And then slowly over time, they realize like, no, it's just like, you know, texting isn't complicated. It's just sending messages to someone else.
Yeah. So this is why I love that question. Like, how do you get that across? And again, I've tried so many different ways and I've evolved the model and I think that I'm getting there now. So here's how I'm, and again, this is just because I'm doing something so poorly, just statistically, it has gotten me to a place where now I think I'm getting better at it. But I think sort of the way that I couch it is, this is actually not about the tool, it's about our brain and how our brain works, right? Because when I sort of saw that I was training companies, and I would train them kind of like on a basic to advanced kind of thing. And that was great, right? The problem was, even though they would say, this is going to transform our organization, I would check back in with them and it hadn't. I mean, it had for them, right? They were like, look how much more we're doing. But I always sort of use the analogy of like, it's like giving a really crappy bicycle to a marathon runner, right? It's like, they're never going to look for what might be parked in the garage, or can they take a flight or something? They're like, this is better than I ever thought. So I call it kind of like the good being the enemy of the perfect, in that when people start using it and they all of a sudden are ripping through emails or brainstorming or writing the Mother's Day note or whatever, it feels so transformational that they don't always look beyond that. So that's number one. The second thing is that around prompt engineering, prompt engineering as a term, it's a technical term. So I'm not trying to sort of discount, engineers, but people have used that now to talk about how to interact with ChatGPT. And it's created this barrier of thinking like, well, I don't really know how to prompt. And So I say, so first of all, you don't know, it's not a thing. Prompt engineering is not a thing. This is why I love what OpenAI put out with their six kind of steps or whatever it was. If you look at the six steps when OpenAI put out something that looks like a prompt engineering guide, it's not really, but it's kind of a best practices. All those things could be used exactly if you were how you would guide a human. Logan, I think I've seen you talk about that too. Like, it's like, if you just took those six principles and said, here's how you're going to talk to your new intern, it works exactly the same, right? So how do we kind of like get to your original question about like, okay, so how do we explain this? So the slide that I usually start with beyond sort of like proving why it's not like showing the data, why it's not a digital transformation, doesn't follow any of the models for a digital transformation or prototypical digital transformation. The first slide I often show is that slide that they love to show, which is like how fast ChatGPT got to a million downloads, right? It's like that 3-day slide. The only thing that shows like Netflix was this long, Spotify this long. And I show that and I'm like, the interesting thing about this is not the ChatGPT thing, right? Because usually people are like, wow, and they move on. The interesting thing about this is everything else on the slide, right? Because everything else, you know what it replaces, right? You know what Netflix replaces. You know what Spotify replaces. Like it's, you know, Blockbuster, your CD collection. And I always throw this out to the audiences. I'm like, what is ChatGPT? What do you think it replaces, right? And so in other words, people are like, well, you know, maybe Google, right? It doesn't, but it sort of acts like Google, which is confusing. Somebody said, our friend Allie Miller, we were out to dinner with her the other night, and she was like, I think it replaces humanity. I'm like, Allie, okay, I don't want to throw her under the bus, but like, I'm like, you can't say that, right? So I don't know if she wants me to say that out loud. But the point, and the chief information officer at Goldman Sachs had the best answer. He said, I think it replaces mediocrity, which is also a great answer. But when you don't know what it replaces, the brain, just because of how our neural pathways work, in the same way, if you see glowing red metal, like you don't go and touch it, like your brain sees this chatbot and it's like, I'm guessing this is Google. And it kind of works like Google, and it immediately limits people. So when I'm doing trainings and stuff, the first thing I do is break them out of that and start talking about it in different kinds of ways.
Connor, I guess quick question off that training too. So is it more so kind of to your point of connecting with these different organizations and folks and sharing use cases as far as like, again, here's a bank that's using it for X, Y, and Z. This is how we implement it. Or is it kind of more so, you know, fighting that perception of, oh, AI is scary. And it's more so kind of just calming them down as far as, right, no, it's not scary to your point. It's supposed to make your life easier, more efficient, and this is how we accomplish that. I guess, you know, how do those conversations usually go? And I'm sure they vary based on industry and size of organization, but you know, kind of just high level, what does that entail?
Yeah. So Nolan, I love this question because you sort of hit on the two things, right? So first, people are very intimidated by it, right? So the first thing, you know, I do take them through a kind of a framework that I use ultimately, right? Which is kind of a three-part framework, which I've changed instead of now, you know, going from basic to advanced. I take them through like how we work, right? Which is like here, you know, what do we do at work, right? We communicate, we make decisions, we strategize, all that kind of stuff. And that's all sort of part of this framework. But the first thing you have to do to your point is demystify it and say, you know, look, come with me on this journey here for a second. I'm going to show you what it's not, but why your brain thinks it's complicated, because in the history of technology, all technology has been sort of complicated. You feel like you do need to kind of be able to get over a certain bar of being quote unquote technical or quote unquote not technical. And by the way, it goes to the point of, to your point question around like sort of it varies by industry. It does and it also doesn't, right? This is why it's not a digital transformation, because digital transformations tend to follow a pattern based on what industry you're in, right? Sort of like, you know, think utility company versus small marketing startup. Do you know what I mean? Like those tend to adapt better or worse to digital transformation. This, as I found over and over again, depends completely on the leadership of the organization and the culture of the organization. Because somebody could be, you know, sort of like just a really older person who thinks they're terrible at tech, but they could be, you know, absolutely crushing this if they understand it well. So part one is just sort of getting them past this notion that this is somehow tech and somehow scary. So I try to put the bar all the way on the floor just because I know people are listening for the moment where they're like, what's the catch? It's like, oh, I have to start running 4 miles a day. That's the catch to getting in shape. It's not just about a better mindset. You know? But that's not what happens here. And the other really interesting thing, and this took me a long time to figure out, is that use cases actually also are hugely detrimental. And I might be alone on this, but when you use use cases, it immediately locks people in to that's what this thing does, right? Instead of it can do anything, this is a solution without a problem, which is really problematic, right? And what does generative AI do essentially, right? It's kind of like taking the it's essentially ripping the user face off AI, right? Which if you know what you're doing is fantastic. If you don't, you're like, well, where do I even begin? Which is why I love how OpenAI has created these GPTs, because it's sort of, it's giving you a little bit more, here's what you, it's all the same technology. It's all the same engine, but it's a, look, I think this is you, like, you know, or your girlfriend, like, you know, Planty, or here, like, here's identified plants, or here's how it's a negotiating thing, or here's how you're going to use it for camp, whatever it is. But use cases, and again, I know this is kind of controversial. People don't like when I say this. Using use cases locks the brain into wrong things. So I'll come into a private equity shop and they'll say, hey, can you tailor your demo to, you know, these use cases? And I'll do that. You know, in early on, I did that. Here's the problem. The skeptics in the room who are waiting for to sort of just say, well, this is why it doesn't work, grab onto it, because I'll do a use case that they've kind of asked me to do. And when it comes out, somebody will say, well, that's not great quality. But for me as the trainer, I have no idea. I don't know if it's good quality or not. I'm not in private equity. So instead, I try to make it kind of like plain vanilla that everybody can map their use cases onto. So I used to go into like a big healthcare company and they would say, give us the top 10 use cases for healthcare. And I used to, I would do my research. I would come in, I would have it. But again, because it would lock it in, I'd come back later and basically those would still be the same kind of use cases they would be using because they were so blown away by them. And I'm like, I don't know anything about healthcare. So now that same conversation sounds more like, tell you what, I'm going to take you through this framework. I'm going to break it all down, what you think it is. I'm going to build back up what how we're going to look at it in a whole new way. We're going to create some new neural pathways. And then you're going to tell me the top use cases in healthcare.
I'm curious if you think the language model tool and application companies should be doing something to address this. Like, you think it's like a, you know, in many ways, GPTs are the opposite of this, where it's like, here's this very concrete thing that like solves this one problem. And I think in many ways that actually is super helpful, like you mentioned, because people show up in ChatGPT today and they're like, I don't know what I'm supposed to do with this. And having a GPT that is like your very clear entry point to the AI ecosystem is really helpful. But I do agree that it is, on the flip side of that, there isn't a lot of this like art of the possible of like very like broad stroke stuff that you can do with this technology. And I'm curious if you have any thoughts about like, or if you've talked to companies that are like trying to address that problem specifically.
Yeah, 100%. And usually I'm the one talking to them about how to do it because you nailed it, right? Like, it is the problem with something like ChatGPT or any large language model. The big problem is that it looks like something that we think we know what it is, and it doesn't act like, it's software that doesn't act like software, and it's tech that doesn't really act like tech, right? So I sort of give the example of like, why is it that it's hard to talk to a baby like a college professor all day, right? It's because your brain automates things very, very quickly. And so when your brain sees a baby, it doesn't have to think like, oh, how do I talk to this little, you know, you just know, right? You're just like, because you've automated it. In the same way, like if you've been working the same job for 20 years, you still make that left out of your driveway because, you know, your brain automates a ton to free up your prefrontal cortex. And so in the same way, it's kind of hard to talk to a baby like a college professor before your brain rips it back. It's very hard for your brain to see something that looks like Google, that looks like a chatbot, that which has been around since the dinosaurs, right? Like, I mean, this is what our brain knows. When we see this, we know that this is it. And it's very hard to form those new neural pathways until you get people actually doing it. So early on, I came up with this kind of like principle called like the HTG principle, which is like, hi, thanks, great. And the idea is like, you know, you say hi to it to sort of remind yourself that you're talking to a human. You say thanks because it's kind of linguistic matching and reminds you that you're talking to something that's actually, you know, worthy of respect. And then great because it's just so good to give it feedback because it thrives on feedback, right? So extremely simple model. And people say, oh, that's how you get ChatGPT to work better. And I say, no, that's how you get your brain to work better because it reminds you. So companies, I don't even think, Logan, that they've identified that as the problem. I think they just don't know how to integrate it. And so I come in and I identify, I'm like, you guys have one problem and here it is, that our brains have a hard time understanding that you can go anywhere and this is going to augment them. So I have some goofy solutions, which again, people think are goofy, but I'm like, imagine in fiction, things like, C-3PO or Jarvis from Iron Man or Data from Star Trek, or just in the movies, you can easily imagine what it feels like to talk to something that sounds so human, even if it's not visible, like her, right? I mean, like Samantha and her, but it sounds so human and it gets the brain kind of triggered in a different way. So if ChatGPT had popped up, or any large language model had popped up, and on your screen it was hyper-realistic, kind of Sora grade, whatever, like me talking, be like, hey, I'm Connor, so what do you want to talk about? Then I think the brain's neural pathway could go more easily to, oh, this is more like Data or something like that, or, you know, from Star Trek, or more like C-3PO or something. It's so what I find over and over again is that it is that, it's that glitch in the brain that I, half of the training is just getting people over that. So I think that's where, I think that's where the next iteration is in terms of getting people to use it more effectively.
I think that's awesome. And Connor, question for me is, again, you kind of have this presence now online, especially LinkedIn. You know, you're someone with a vast following. You have a newsletter, a podcast. You know, you talked about earlier, you know, coming from a non-technical background. How does someone like you kind of immerse yourself in enough information or material to kind of have that credibility to go talk to these different organizations, you know, have all the success? You know, where do you personally find this information? And obviously, I'm guessing, you know, there's a lot of back and forth and trying to connect the dots between what's working, what's not working. But, you know, I'm just fascinated as far as, you know, what you're able to put out. And I look at your LinkedIn post all the time, and I'm like, oh, had no idea. Thank you, Connor, for sharing with this. So I guess I'm kind of curious where you get that from.
Yeah, no, I mean, thanks for saying that. I think I would argue that it's actually in this particular way, it's sort of it's an advantage not to have a tech background for this very narrow thing that I'm trying to do, right? Which is sort of trying to educate and train and things like that. And the reason is, I think in the same way, it's almost like an advantage if you're trying to get somebody into shape. It's almost an advantage if you're a personal trainer, like, you know, struggled with weight not so long ago, because they sort of like understand what seems strange about all this, where I think it's, you know, the folks who are more technical are almost at a slight disadvantage in a funny way, because it's hard for them to see what they don't know. Do you know what I mean? Like, because it's so in tune. So I, sort of dumb example maybe, but like I wrote a book about Nepal. It's like a memoir, and luckily I had kept a journal all the, you know, every day that I was doing it. So when I went back and ended up writing the book, I was able to capture like the awe of seeing 50 people riding on top of a bus. Whereas now I've spent so much time in Nepal, for example, that if I go back 10 years later, I don't even see that. It doesn't occur to me that that's strange, or that I might need to point that out to somebody. So if I bring somebody to Kathmandu, it's always funny. Like, I'll walk past something I don't even see, and they're like, what is that? Do you know what I mean? Like, because they're seeing it. So I have that very fresh perspective of non-technical and being blown away by, like, holy cow, this is crazy. Where if somebody's been using like a GPT model for, you know, long before it kind of came out as a consumer facing thing, it might be harder for them to see it. Or if somebody's been doing machine learning for a long time, it might be harder to sort of see like what's interesting about it, you know, if that makes sense, and why non-tech people, which is the majority of the planet just by definition, see is interesting about it. So I think in terms of how I'm able to train on it, and I have a background a little bit in training, so that helps a little bit, but it is actually that naivete that ironically helps, right? So there's that. And then the other thing about how I get all the information, this is wild, right? It's just, you know, so first of all, I probably read like, you know, 5 or 6 newsletters a day. I probably listen to like a couple podcasts a day. Like, I'm following the news. I like on, and X, Twitter is like a phenomenal source of news, but this is the really funny thing, right? I get asked all the time, like, what book should I read? I'm like, what book you should read? Like, dude, there's no book. I mean, like, if The Verge has an article, we're in luck. You know what I mean? Like, otherwise, like, we're going to go on X. We're going to go find Logan. We're going to go find Ethan Mollick. We're going to go find Ali Miller. We're going to go find people like that. You know, Rowan Chung. We're going to find The Neuron. We're going to find things like that and just see, like, what did they just discover? That moment, like, what did they just come out? So like the new things that come out, people are like, well, how do you figure out how it's doing? I'm like, I don't know any other way except to go and test it myself. I can't do that with everything, but I do as much as I can. And then I have the people that I trust. So I don't want people to think like, I get asked that question all the time, as I'm sure you guys do too. How do you keep up with this? I know you guys get asked that. For me, I'm just like, you know what? I have to devote a lot of time to it. So it's not a magic thing where it's like, hey, this one thing, a lot of great newsletters out there, a lot of great podcasts, all that kind of stuff. I just try to listen to a bunch of them and sort of see what's popping up that day.
No, yeah, I think that's awesome. It's a very unique perspective to your end too. I think that you kind of hit the nail on the head where there is definitely a benefit from someone coming in with kind of that blank mindset where they don't have that technical resource background. So hopefully that's optimistic for all of our listeners out there who don't have a technical background, that you could someday be in Connor's shoes. And I'm sure that both your podcast and newsletter are trying to help, you know, the everyday folks kind of stay up to date, such as you are as well. I guess another quick question too, and kind of dealing with academia, which I feel like is an area in which large language models, AI is kind of getting, you know, a good rep, bad rep, you know, some institutions are kind of banning it. You know, how do you, I guess, at NYU School of Stern, you know, view AI, large language models, being able to use it? You know, obviously I think from just having a conversation with you, you obviously think it's a positive thing. But there's still faculty kind of pushing back on the idea of, hey, we should not be letting, you know, our students use this. I guess kind of what are your thoughts and perceptions on that?
Yeah, it's academia is the hard. I mean, that was going to be the first big problem that I think we had to solve, right? I think OpenAI saw that as well. I mean, it's just, how do you take something where, you know, young people are going to be cranking on it, and you know, not just because they're good at tech, but just because I have theories on that. Like, I think it's, they don't have a deep embedded level of expertise that they feel like they have to validate their own expertise over and over again, as humans do. And so they're more willing to just do that. And they're also more willing to be like, hey, I wonder if I can do this, which is usually like a parent's worst nightmare. But like in this case, it's like, you know, this is how they're learning. Academia is slow. It is just slow. I mean, it's one of these things where, you know, faculty, and I'm not talking about just like NYU, but faculty and I grew up in a faculty family, you know, it's understandable when you have devoted your whole life to something and you know that how you teach something is extremely effective, to then be wary when something comes in and all of a sudden you can't assign, you know, a take home paper on Hamlet anymore. You like the whole proxy for grading has really been disrupted. And that, for the first time in like 3,000 years, right? I mean, like, you know, maybe the calculator did some of this and all that kind of stuff, but like, it's very, very disruptive. And so I think that the best approach that I've found about it is going to faculty, and I talk to faculty a lot, obviously, is saying, yeah, students now have like their Iron Man suit, right? They now have like this way that they can just crank on this, all that kind of stuff. But guess what? You do too. Do you know what I mean? Like, so what I say is like, put your stuff through ChatGPT, and just sort of super basic example, I'm like, throw your syllabus in there and then say, I'm not a huge guy with like, act like a, I that's not usually how I prompt, although I see the value of it. But in this case, I sort of say like, hey, pretend you're like a faculty member, and the world has always had generative AI at the capability that is now or better. How should I grade students when I'm trying to get across this information, understanding that they could easily take it home and there's no real way to detect, at least text-based generated AI, or, you know, generative AI. So I kind of ask faculty, and then faculty find brand new ways of doing it. It becomes much more experiential. Like, the learning process becomes way more fun for faculty that leans into it. But I'm sympathetic. Do you know what I mean? Like, because the prospect for cheating is much greater. But now I'm seeing more and more, especially where we are at St. Luke's School here up in Connecticut, for example. It's one of these things where, you know, the faculty is like really leaning into it and really saying like, well, what's going to be a new way of teaching? That's a hard thing for faculty to do. So I really applaud when they're able to do it. But it's hard and it's scary. And I think the more that we sort of show them how they can apply this to their own syllabus, for example, the better off probably we're going
to
be.
Something that's really interesting that's related to this is what you talk about all the time, Connor, which is the idea that, you know, the reversion back to English majors being such an incredibly important major. And I think for a long time, you know, you would go and say you studied English or writing or something, and everyone would be like, what a waste of money, what a waste of time. And it's hilarious now that it's like, well, those people are actually going to be very well suited. And I'm curious, like, what you think the broad implication of that, if the example of English major specifically is actually true, or maybe there's like a little more nuance to it than specifically English majors, but I'd love to hear you double click on that.
Yeah, I actually really do believe that. And look, I mean, this is a complete bias because I grew up in a family of English majors and I was, you know, political science. So how easy it is for me to be like, you know what the best major is, guys? Political science, right? So, but actually there's really something to it. And obviously I'm far from the first person to say this. I mean, Jensen Huang was saying this just on stage the other day too, right? It's like, not to say don't have your students studying this, right? You know, STEM and all that kind of stuff, because it's great. You know, our friend Justin Feinberg over at Cassidy was sort of saying something around this too, where he was saying like, you know, computer science, I would still go back and study that just because of how it gets your brain thinking. However, I sort of like half say this, and it's not even in jest, but it really is. I mean, the, you know, heads of, you know, IBM's AI and all this kind of stuff are saying similar things, saying that obviously natural language and is the, in a way, the new coding thing, right? And that's not me. That's, you know, OpenAI guys from a long time ago. But it's critical because the more that you can sort of act like this is going to be a conversation and you're going to iterate, and what are some interesting ways of trying to get, you know, elicit information from people. That's interesting. And in fact, I've been thinking about this recently too, which is, it's funny, like if you become a consultant, right? Like a management consultant at McKinsey, and if you can become like an executive coach, right? Both those things actually require a huge amount of training, because as a consultant, you have to know, you have to ask enough questions where you find out what it is. And then you have to have very hard conversations with your client who are paying you a lot of money, saying like, look, we've seen this before. This is how you do this. Coaching is the exact opposite, right? Coaching, it's all in the question. It's all how you frame the question, right? It's all like you can't give the person advice, because then they won't be locking it into their brain. They have to come up with their own things. And I think with prompting, it's almost sort of somewhere in the middle. It's more, you know, dealing with generative AI, it's more like you have to have a very strong grasp of what you're trying to accomplish and what you know, what expertise you bring to that. And I think people who study a lot of communication in whatever field that is tend to just be quite good at eliciting that and understanding, because they don't tend to be the ones generating the intellectual property. They tend to be the ones sort of taking that and communicating it somewhere else. And that tends to just pair very well with large language models.
Do you think this trend, and I've seen this narrative online about the trend of like humans becoming managers and like AIs, like we're all managers and like AI systems are like our employees or counterparts or whatever. Do you think that is like this, the natural trend that we're moving towards, or is there some other outcome of this English-based prompting being the future of the way that we communicate with AI models?
That's such a good question. It's hard to say. I mean, like, you know, again, Sam Altman came out when the GPTs were announced. And the first thing he said in that dev days, you know, better than anyone, Logan, is he started talking about agents before he talked about GPTs, which I thought we were going in a totally different direction when he started to it. I was watching it live. And then all of a sudden, nobody came back to that. And part of it was probably just like, people are going to want to hear about agents. Let's talk about that. But I thought it was so interesting because you just sort of see how it's such a slow evolution. I think that, you know, in our minds, it's going to be like, oh, you know, there's going to be a moment where like this thing pops up. And it's like, hey, I'm Mindy, you're helpful, blah, blah, blah. And you just tell me everything that I need to do. But it's actually not that. It is this sort of slow evolution and sort of like offloading certain tasks. And again, I heard Sam Altman say something along the lines of like, this thing isn't great at jobs, it's great at tasks, right? Which is something I borrow from him all the time when I'm talking to companies, because people are worried about taking their jobs. And so I think your question also goes down to that, like if that is true, and I do think there's a lot of truth in that, then you sure need a lot fewer humans in theory. Now I'm not sure that that's true, because I guess further down the road, but I'm sort of talking maybe in the next year or something like that. ChatGPT was just sitting there, it isn't something, right? I mean, like it's an empty box. What it does is it really accelerates the how one person thinks and the information that they have in their head, right? So I could go up against, you know, I could have like a hackathon with a marketing guru, and I can actually probably get pretty far with just ChatGPT with no marketing background. The problem is I start to slow down because I don't know what good quality looks like. I don't know where to guide it. I don't know any of that stuff. And the person who's been studying marketing understands quality, understands how you tweak things, understands where to go with it. So they're going to be so far ahead of me ultimately, even though I will be, if you believe the BCG study, and I do, the one that Ethan Mollick and everybody else did, like, you know, 42% gain off people who are sort of like lower skilled. That would be me, right? And a 17% gain for people who are higher skilled. So I think that there's a lot of truth to sort of like people going to be managing this, but I think that so much is still going to depend on like, what's the lived experience of that person and how do they, how can they use this to augment them? So I think that is maybe true down the road, but I still think it's going to be a little while before we get there.
I think another question I had, and this stemmed kind of from the conversation earlier where you talked about being able to go in, you know, have conversations with these different organizations on how to implement AI. But I guess on the flip side of that, what actual tangible returns are you seeing from organizations that are implementing AI? Again, I think that there's, you know, implement AI is a big buzzword, you could do it, but what actually are people seeing in return from actually doing some of these things that other organizations can learn from, or, you know, individuals can kind of learn from too? I'm curious to see what results are driven from this.
Yeah, it's funny. I get asked a lot, and you guys probably do too, like which organizations are doing this well? And the truth is that there's none that I can really point to yet. I'm sure that, I mean, but we're all, this is fairly nascent still. I will say sort of like that the better, in terms of my own empirical data, which is pretty extensive at this point, I think. The organizations that I see using this fairly well are either organizations that are fairly small, less than 100 people, who everybody's trying to do like five things and they're just desperate for something. And so they have no choice. Or organizations that are on the larger side that have a very strong learning and trust culture. Because when you see your leader sort of saying like, look, and this is kind of the term that I use, is like AI is designed to go through our people. It's not like around our people. Do you know what I mean? Like, it is, and being vulnerable with how they're trying it and sort of saying like, look, we're all on this learning journey together and we can't do this without you. This is going to, we've hired you so this can augment you, not the other way around. Like that kind of leadership and culture really does very well with generative AI, right? Especially sort of allaying fears and things like that, which is, I mean, half the battle, as you kind of alluded to earlier, Nolan, right? But like, but in terms of sort of like which organizations are doing it well and what's the ROI on it, I've seen it more in pockets than as an organization. So I've seen like just really small teams where they have like three or four people in like their digital marketing or whatever. And they're like, holy cow, like just look at what we're producing now in terms of not just scale of work, but also just quality of work, because quality essentially comes from iteration usually, right? So like, so it's just that iterative pattern that they've gotten into. They've condensed, you know, their workflows from, you know, sort of like the non-value add tasks down. So, so in pockets, you see the ROI. It's what I sort of do and what I do with companies is I work first with the board or the senior leadership instead of working with the teams. And I have been brought in to work with the teams before. The challenge with that is that when I train sort of like this kind of half inspirational, half training, because it, like exercise, right? You have to get people to kind of like decide that they want to feel better and look better and all that kind of stuff. The problem with exercise is that the dopamine doesn't come until way further down the road. Whereas ChatGPT, the dopamine hits right away, which makes it easier. But when I'm working with teams first, the challenge is that people change how they work, and you know, they make their 8-hour day a 6-hour day, and they're all of a sudden up for promotion because the quality of their work, all that kind of stuff. But that doesn't tend to hit the revenue at scale, right? It doesn't tend to drive the bottom line. It tends to drive engagement and, you know, worker satisfaction and you know, team productivity and things like that, but not at scale. So when I do this, I tend to work with boards of directors or senior management teams first. And that's critical, because the first thing we have to do in an organization is to set new benchmarks for the organization. So I do the same kind of training that I would do with the workforce, including take them through the framework and show them what this looks like at scale when people are doing it in, you know, one task after another, rather than this Google command response, walk away kind of thing. So when I show them that, then they're like, oh, now we see what the new benchmarks for like an 8-hour day should look like and all that kind of stuff. And then I go to the team. So when I think about ROI, it has to sort of like trickle down a little bit. And so I've seen ROI kind of in small pockets, but I think it's pretty early to see it. I see people on the journey, but I haven't seen it yet at scale.
Yeah. And I think you hit the nail on the head too when you say it is still early, right? People are still trying to just get their feet wet and see. I mean, obviously it will be a few years before you can probably pull an actual tangible ROI. And I guess the follow-up question, and maybe you hit on it there too, was who are you usually seeing champion, you know, this kind of initiative within an organization that maybe reaches out to you? Is it usually the C-level board individuals, or are people more so at a management position who just, you know, maybe have been following along, learning, and say, you know, this could be really, really valuable for us too?
Yeah, I get reached out to by, usually C-suite type or C-suite adjacent people saying, hey, can you come in? And usually like at this stage, there's a lot of, hey, our board knows that we're supposed to be doing something, but they're not sure exactly what, where our senior management team can sort of see that this, or you get one or two people who are like, hey, I'm the chief operating officer and I'm using this like crazy, but I've talked to people, but it's not catching fire. And to that, I'm always like, yeah. And Logan, it's kind of how you and I were talking a little earlier. It's like, because there's a block there that people don't realize. Like when it's sort of like why Michael Jordan makes a terrible basketball coach. It's like, just do this, man. And then just do this. And like, they don't know what the hurdle is, because when the dopamine hits you and you start taking off and you start using it for everything, you cannot understand. It's probably like people who do yoga. I don't know. Have you met these people? Like they're like, why are you doing yoga every day, man? Like it makes you feel good. I'm like, you know, like it hurts, you know? So I'm guessing that when people experience it, they're just like, how can everybody not be doing this? All you have to do is get up in the morning and get a yoga mat and you're good. Like you don't need anything else. So I think with ChatGPT, the challenge is not, you know, sort of like, hey, we don't have an enterprise subscription for everybody. It's that people have not reframed it in the way they need to reframe it. So I get called in typically by either people who are frustrated because they know that it's there, but they don't know what they're even supposed to be asking, or people who are champions but have been unable to really spread the word to the rest of the organization.
That's so interesting, Connor. When you go in and have these conversations with folks, you know, just putting in perspective today, like we just had Anthropic's Claude 3 come out. We had Gemini Pro 1.5 last week. We had a new Mistral model. I'm sure there'll be a bunch of other models in the next few weeks and months to come. Do you find that companies care about that type of stuff? Like when you go in and have conversations, are they like, oh, tell us about the latest models and like what that means? Or are they sort of abstracted away from those details and are really like just trying to, Connor, I'm curious, like as these new models come online, do companies care about that? Are they like asking you about the latest model and like what the new modalities are? Or are companies like still early on the adoption curve and not really interested in like the latest developments from a model perspective?
Way earlier on the curve. I could almost count on the maybe two hands, I guess, but people who have said, well, what about Bard? I get that kind of question because it's Google. You know what I mean? Like, or I'm trying to even think. I mean, sometimes people say like, well, what do you think about, I mean, at the absolute advanced stage, it's what do you think about MS Copilot versus like an OpenAI Enterprise or something like that? That's about as advanced in terms of that the questions get. I don't think I've ever gotten a question about open source. And that's where, you know, we sort of live in a bubble, right? And that's where I'm trying to kind of stay out of the bubble because I think it's so valuable to be out of the bubble and sort of see what people are thinking. But I'm traveling all the time, sort of like going out and talking to companies. I'm talking in within NYU and all that kind of stuff. Obviously, that's like that's where I live all the time. But it is very, very basic. And I don't even mean that in a pejorative way. It's just where people are. So people do. So kind of to maybe give a better sense, I introduce people to Perplexity 99% of the time, right? And that it feels like it's not that it's a big thing, but you know, relative to some other things, but it's so easy to use. I'm like, guys, just check out Perplexity or something like that. But things like, you know, Mistral and Claude, sometimes people have tried Claude and they would have tried it because it used to have the much bigger context window. So people kind of almost by necessity went out and found it. That's why it exists in their brain. But anything else, if you're talking about, you know, inflection or anything like that, nobody that I've run into really knows unless they're deep dive. So it's at a very, very early stage. And it makes me wonder sort of like how these kind of quote unquote wars are going to be won. I actually don't think it's going to be a war, but I think that in the architectural front, people are much more interested in like, how does this work with our data? Which cloud provider do we use? Things like that, which are questions they're much more accustomed to asking.
Yeah, I was just chatting with Arvind last night from Perplexity. And I think this very naturally leads me to the question of what your own like personal AI productivity stack looks like when you go to talk to companies. Like, are you trying like all of the tools and try to incorporate as many of them? Or do you have like a core set that you're using on like a daily or weekly basis?
Yeah, for sure. It's fairly limited. So I came across Perplexity pretty early on, and I remember hearing that there were only 15,000 paid subscribers, and I'm like, I am one of these paid subscribers to this. So tell Arvind that I've gotten him. I got Bezos on board. I feel like I got everybody on board with this. So like, I have just been like shouting from the rooftops about Perplexity forever, and then all of a sudden, yeah, stupid Bezos comes along, invests, and everybody's like, what's Perplexity? I'm like, whatever, man. So anyway, so I've been a paid subscriber to that for a long time. It's my tech stack is pretty close to OpenAI and Perplexity. And even with Perplexity, the model, I tend to use their fine-tuned model, which I don't know if that's built on but I don't even often, I forget to go to GPT-4 in terms of the output, just because their fine-tuned model is really, really good. I just test drove Perplexity, which whenever you're airing this, it was announced a few hours ago. So I just went on, I just bought Opus, which is their big model. Tried that out. I thought it was good for some things, outstanding for voice. So I thought that was really cool. I got Google gave me early access to 1.5 Pro, which in terms of context window, I thought did really, really well. On the video front, did pretty well, but nothing kind of game changing. The game changing stuff tends to come out of OpenAI around, you know, this idea of memory around GPT, things like that, Sora. Those are sort of like, OpenAI keeps putting out stuff that makes your jaw drop. And that's like whereas everything else feels better, iterative, things like that. But for me, it's that. And then I really go into systems that I'm already using. And I just, the advice I always give, I'm like, I don't want to say forget about other AI tools, because I know there's a lot of people working very hard on these things and there's some great things out there. But as a general rule, I say, look at what you're already using. Canva has phenomenal AI tools in it. Do you know what I mean? Like things like MS Teams, phenomenal. Just in things that you wish you could do, take notes, transcribe those notes, process those notes, and Canva, all the automatic stuff. So I tend to keep it fairly straightforward, and I don't tend to go out and tell people a lot of AI tools, because then I think they think that there's must be 50 if there's 10. And instead, I'm like, look, here's five. Here's not even. Here's three. Let's just look at those.
I have a really, really quick tactical question, which is when you're in conversations with people who are just getting started with AI tools and large language models, how do you talk about the context window? I feel like it's such an unintuitive topic, and it seems like kind of scary and like confusing to a lot of folks who like aren't familiar with AI.
This is why I tend to try to avoid almost all terms that sound like that, right? So it's funny, right? So like context window, token count, prompt engineering, single shot, zero shot prompting, all that kind of stuff. It drives me crazy, because understandably these are technical terms that come down. And so of course they're carried on, but I try to be like the dam that's holding back this giant lake. And then the stuff that I'm like spitting out is in creek sized form. So in other words, like when I talk about context window, I almost never say context window. I do if I'm on LinkedIn, because that's our bubble in there. But if I'm out at a company, I'm like, so, you know, GPT used to have, I almost got down to the word count. Logan, you know better than me, but like I found it was like 2,400 words kind of thing around, right? You could upload. I'm like, but if you go over to Claude, you know, you could upload 75,000 words or something like that. So it's just great, especially with PDFs and things like that. They're just like giant, you know, put in your documents. So I just like, it can just like ingest more when you put it in. I never talk about tokens. It's too confusing. And even context window, same thing, like zero shot, single shot prompting. I never say, I'm like, give it examples. It's better if you give it examples, but it's fine tuned enough that you actually probably don't even really need to give it examples in the same way you used to. And by the way, people are always like, so what's the history? I'm like, don't worry about the history. Do you know what I mean? Like, 'cause who cares? Like, you know what I mean? Like, nobody's talking about like, well, the iPhone 8, like when you're talking about like what the camera can do now, who cares? So instead, again, it's maybe interesting for us, but people are, when they're asking questions, I sense, because I don't come from a tech background, or I come from a non-tech background myself, I get the very strong sense that people are looking for the moment that they're not going to understand. It's like, as I sort of said in the beginning, when I started this, I kept looking for, where's the curve going to come? When is that I'm going to sort of like need to like understand machine learning? It never came. And that's the interesting thing to me. So again, I just talk about like, you know, if you give it better examples, you know, if you give it examples, it'll understand what you're asking for a little better, what kind of output you want it for. Or, you know, if you're sort of, you know, now the context, or now I sort of say like it can take more of your documents in and just like, you know, read them better. So I try to sort of stay away as much as possible from any of those terms.
And then Connor, quick question before we get to our last question of the day. Obviously, I think it's been, what, a few months now since you've rolled out the AI Mindset newsletter. What was the reasoning behind doing that? You know, folks who are interested in kind of staying up to date and continuing to kind of follow your journey. And like I said, you're just a great resource for myself, and I'm sure a lot of people who want to stay on top of this stuff. What is that newsletter looking to do? Where can people kind of find it? And kind of just brief overview as to why you wanted to kind of roll that out.
Yeah, no, thanks for bringing it up. Thanks for asking. So I was trying to put together kind of a framework around how I think about this, because I go out and I'm always posting on LinkedIn and all that kind of stuff. But I was realizing that, first of all, I'm kind of a writer by background, so I sort of missed the newsletter. And there's some great newsletters out there already sort of saying, hey, up to the minute, you know, here's what's happening. And I like that. And I have like an AI news of the week kind of thing. It comes out weekly. But I really wanted to explain in real life terms, like, what is this and how do you actually get better at it? Not just, hey, copy and paste this prompt, which I'm personally not a big fan of, just because I feel like the copy and pasting of the prompt, you have to strike lightning, right? In other words, like if you have like a YouTube channel and that YouTube channel is how to install a lamppost and there's 9,000 views, I guarantee all 9,000 were people that were about to install a lamppost. Nobody's just like watching that for fun, right? So when people sort of like, hey, here's a prompt that can help you do your sales, blah, 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 nobody's going to copy that and then hold on to it for a month until they actually have to do that thing. So I'd rather talk about the conceptually, how are you going to develop all your own stuff? So the first newsletter I put out, I think 5 weeks ago now, was I think called something like The Truth About Prompting or something. And it focused on OpenAI's six steps, because I'm like, guys, like, look at what they're saying here. This is not, okay, first to understand token count and single shot prompting and bubble. No, it's saying, hey, so give it context. Hey, you know, sort of, you know, be patient and when you're iterating. It was glorious, right? Meta came out with, Meta Engineer came out with something kind of similar. And so I wanted to sort of say in there, like, if you want to know how to kind of quote unquote prompt, here's what you need to know. Imagine it's like this. So I give a lot of like examples and things like that, or like why teens are so good at it. It's not because they're better at tech, right? It's because, again, as we were sort of saying, it's because they're not afraid to say like, I wonder if it can do this and see how far they can push things. That's very teenager mentality. And they also sort of say like, they're not locked into like their own frame of knowledge, which we need because we have to validate our education and where we are in our position. They're like, I don't care. Like if something is teaching me, something's teaching me. Just things like that. So my newsletters really focus on like, I hope that if people read it, they'll get a better sense of just like how to do this. And so, and that kind of, it ties into this AI mindset framework, which is what I go out and do training of companies and things like that. I'm hoping to, I'm starting to work on a digital course and things like that around that, because I just want, you know, I think you guys have the same kind of why, which is like, I'm extremely eager to just have the whole world using this. I think it's going to make the world a better place. And that's kind of the impetus behind it.
I've been in and out the majority of the time. So we're back here. And again, we will link that link to the newsletter and everything that we do publish. But the last thing we like to ask our guests is, again, we're 2 months into 2024. One thing you're really excited for in this new year, and then one thing that perhaps you're a little nervous about, maybe hope doesn't come to fruition, but kind of, you know, both sides of positive and negatives in 2024.
Yeah, for me, I'm really excited about the future in terms of the personalization of all this. I think that that's just huge. I think that ChatGPT with a memory is going to be, I think, really game changing, where it's really starting to learn you more and more. I just get really excited about that for content creators, just to sort of say like, hey, this is my voice and this is my brand. And I'm hoping that that all sort of converges, so we're not going to a lot of different tools. Not that I'm not rooting for all the tools that do all that kind of brand stuff, but just it would be great if in one place it just can get to know you better, right? In the same way like your intern or assistant gets to know you better and understands what good looks like to you. That's the thing I'm most excited about. What I'm most fearful about is, you know, probably stating the obvious, but, you know, going into an election season, you know, the deep fakes is always going to be a huge, huge challenge. I don't know. I'm not as sort of like terrified as other people maybe, because I feel like we've already had deep fake in terms of images and things like that. For me, it's really the voice stuff. You know, 11 Labs does a great job, not too good a job, I'm saying, but like, it is very, very hard to detect whether this is Connor talking or whether this is sort of like 11 Labs Connor talking or any other tool talking. And I think my big concern tends to be for the elderly, to be totally frank, right? It's sort of like, this tends to be a population that doesn't even know that this thing is out there. And I think it's just going to get easier and easier, especially with some of the tools that are sort of doing automatic calling and things like that, which now they have more regulation on. But I just worry about them. You know what I mean? Like, I worry about our population that doesn't understand it. But for the most part, I'm hugely optimistic and excited to see what comes next.
I love that. Connor, this was such a fun conversation. I think me and Nolan are your number one and number two fans, and I won't say who is which. We'll have to talk off camera about that. But this was a ton of fun. And I think like you, the work that you're doing, I think is incredibly important. And I think there are not enough people who are doing the type of work that you're doing. And I'm personally appreciative that you're sort of educating the masses on how to use this technology, because it's for the trajectory of humanity, I think it's really important. So thanks for that hard work.
Yeah, thanks guys. Yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, this was a ton of fun.
Phenomenal.